and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. I'm Holly Rubinstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by the much-loved chef, restaurateur and TV presenter, Tom Kerridge. Tom's worked in food since he was 18 years old, but he rose to fame when his pub in Buckinghamshire, The Hand and Flowers, went on to become the only pub in Britain with 2 Michelin stars. I, like many, got to know and love him on the BBC's Great British Menu show, where he was the first chef to cook at the banquet 2 years in a row, and he's since gone on to release several best-selling cookbooks and many popular TV shows. More recently, he's made headlines with his dramatic 12-stone weight loss. As well as chatting a bit about that, Tom takes us on a journey across the UK, Europe, Asia, and the US with his travel diaries and lots of foodie recommendations along the way. This is what I call a long-haul episode. You're getting a bit more this week because Tom is so lovely and we just couldn't stop chatting. And I hope you'll really enjoy it. So let's hear from Tom Kerridge. Tom Kerridge, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, mate. Thanks for having me.
I imagine that your life has involved a huge amount of travel, so I'm really excited to hear about some of the places you've been. But actually, let's start at the very beginning, first of all. And that's chapter one, which is your earliest childhood travel memory.
It's quite weird because it's within this country, but it was kind of, so I grew up single parent family. It was just me, mum, and myself and my brother. So she was kind of like bringing up 2 kids, and everyone else in and around the area where we lived would get on holiday, and they would go abroad. They would go to Spain, or they would go, you know, it was, you know, package holidays from the late 70s and early 80s. And, you know, as young kids, we were like, you know, seeing people go off on holiday. So my mum came up with the idea, and I look back at it and it's great, but our third earliest travel memories was Isle of Wight, going on holiday to the Isle of Wight, and it felt like you were leaving somewhere, getting on a ferry, you know, in my mum's car, she'd drive us, we'd get on the ferry and actually leaving the coast and going somewhere else. I mean, it's a tiny little ferry ride.
Just going off to an island, though, just makes it feel like you're heading somewhere, right?
Exactly. It was super special. And we would go to and it would be like a holiday park, a little bit like Butlins, but wasn't. It was, you know, the same sort of huts that you'd stay in. It was a little bit like Heidi High when I look back at it, that kind of thing, with an indoor and an outdoor swimming pool, but I don't think they were heated. But it was just, I mean, there would always be loads of kids playing, and I just remember, you know, it had its own arcade, and it was just a great place to hang out and have fun and enjoy being there. And it was just it felt like, as children, we were going on holiday, and it was special. And the Isle of Wight is lovely. I mean, I haven't been back for years and years and years, but I just remember it as a magical island and a special place as a child.
It is a really beautiful place. I was actually there in the summer. And as you say, that ferry ride in itself, just going across, seeing the coastline, it shows how beautiful parts of Britain are worth going on holiday to.
Yeah, exactly. It's weird, isn't it? Because you don't think about it when you're here, and then you go up and, you know, and you see all the tourists coming here and coming to see the sights. And actually, a celebration of Great Britain is amazing. We are an incredible island with some beautiful places to visit. But yeah, you get on that ferry, you see the needles, and you see that, you know, and you just say, actually, this is amazing. It's like, we should be super proud of this country and our coastline and our holiday spaces that we go to. But yeah, that was a real, they were wonderful childhood memories, amazing holidays, and they felt very, it did feel very special. My mum was very good at making us feel that we weren't missing out on anything, even though there wasn't a lot of money there.
That's really nice. And so you're saying your friends were going off to Spain and places that were abroad. When was the first time that you went abroad?
So I did a school trip. We did something in France for a day to the north of France. We went to Austria skiing when I was 15. And I remember having to save for that for ages between me and my mum.
And was that exciting?
It was amazing going to a foreign country. It was brilliant. It was absolutely fantastic. But I think the first time I got on a plane, I don't think I was until I was 18, 19, 20. You know, there was things that I hadn't been on or hadn't done. It's just because there wasn't the money. There wasn't the spaces there. I mean, I remember going to first foreign trip, kind of like a weekend. Again, it was my mum. We went to Ostend in Belgium. And it was, again, getting a ferry over to somewhere else. That wasn't a plane flight. It wasn't, anything as extravagant as that. But then I think the first real holiday as such that I actually remember having of going, this is amazing. And it wasn't until I met my wife, Beth, so I was 25 years old. Mm-hmm. And we went on holiday to Greece. We went to a little tiny island called Agistri. Now, Beth is well traveled. She left home and she spent 2 years chasing the snow around the Alps skiing. She went and she lived in Greece for a year and a half working in bars. She's done, she got out, she left home, went out there, went to college, then she went to university, then she went on to the Royal College of Art, and then after that she's done stuff. Mm-hmm.
She's a very successful sculptor, isn't she?
She is. She's very successful. She's great. She's done, parts of the travel that we've come up to in, Dubai is a big space. She's got a huge piece of work at the front of the Dubai Opera House, She carves a lot of marble out in Italy, in Carrara, where the marble is. And then she built this piece. So she was out in Italy for about 9 months on and off building this piece that then got shipped out to Dubai. So, her travel, she's up for travel.
Travel's integral to her career too.
Exactly. Yeah. And she being inspired. She's inspired me, and travels have been hugely inspiring. But she was the first person, because of her time of living in Greece and how much she loves it, and not like party Greece, not like get out there, nightclubs, actually living there behind the scenes, the little fishing port and the beautiful villages. And we went to this beautiful tiny island called Agistri.
I've never heard of Agistri.
Yeah, it's about an hour's ferry ride from Athens. So I remember flew into Athens. It was one of those cheap flights that you get into Athens really early in the morning, and then you get a ferry. And I remember getting the ferry into this beautiful little island, and the sun was just coming up, and the first thing I did is jump in the sea and swim. It was just like, I couldn't believe why I'd never been on proper holiday before. I couldn't believe that, I left school and I went straight into a kitchen pretty much from the age of 18. For 7 years, I'd just been working as a chef and never had a holiday really. And, if I did have holiday, it'd be down to Cornwall with me mates drinking cider and all of a sudden, I'd met this amazing girl and she said, let's go to Greece. And I thought it'd be like proper party. And it was just amazing. And we've been going to Greece probably, I'd say, on and off every year since then. So, the last 20 years, backwards and forwards to Greece and different islands and Cyprus and Crete. And, I just absolutely love it. And I love Greek food. I love the way that there's a small vocabulary Greek food. It's not huge, but what they do is beautiful. When it's looked up, it's so immersive of the environment. It's very dry. It's very rustic. They're great with dried herbs. We always talk about in cooking about the use of wonderful fresh herbs, and that's amazing. But Greek cookery really does embrace dried herbs, and so that kind of like arid cooking that's big on flavour, but it's just something very, very special. Things like Cypriot potatoes, the soil that works so well that creates this wonderful flavour. I'm hugely in love with Greek food, Greek cooking, and the islands of Greece. So that was kind of my first real holiday, and it's one that I've fallen in love with massively.
Well, speaking of falling in love, chapter two is the first place that you fell in love with. Is that Greece?
100%. Like, Greece is the first place that as a holiday destination that I've definitely fallen in love with. And since being with Beth, we've travelled lots and been to see lots. And since, finding myself in this position as a chef to be able to cook and be asked to do things all over the world, the place where we go back to as somewhere where we would look at for a holiday destination is somewhere in the Greek islands, you know, and they're amazing.
And they're so varied from island to island, aren't they? So you can get a completely different feel depending on which collection of islands you visit.
Yeah.
So which are some of your favourites?
Actually, the last 3 years we've been going to Crete. So
lovely.
Yeah, and it's an incredible, beautiful island. It's a wonderful space. Warm waters, lovely people, great food. So many parts of it are even though it's busy and you find the right restaurants, there's some incredible places there that just do very, very simple food. And, you know, my life is about food. And if you go on holiday, I don't want to fall into the tourist trap. And, you know, I remember actually, it was a Cypriot island when we first went to Cyprus. And we went to Paphos and we stayed at this lovely hotel. And hotel food is great, but it's nice to get out and go and find where everybody goes and get in there. So we jumped in a taxi and said, take us into town. And then as the taxi driver was driving us into town, we go, no, just take us to, you know, where the restaurants are. And as you drive into town, we drive past this tiny little, like, kind of like Greek tavern. And he goes, oh, yeah, that's where I go. That's where all the taxi drivers go. And we carried on driving. And he dropped us in town. And there was a Chinese. And then there was, like, a Mexican place. And there was, like, I was like, what are we doing here? The restaurants at the front of Paphos. And, you know, there's some that are all right. There's some that, but it's very touristy. And I just said, why are we here? I want to go back to where the taxi drivers go. So we walked back up the hill to this brilliant, brilliant restaurant where there were three ladies in the kitchen doing lamb stews and roasting chickens on coals. And it was just the most magical, amazing, beautiful restaurant. Very simple, sat under vine leaves, eating great, great, great Greek food. And it was wonderful. And those, so yeah, that's where we've fallen in love with the food and the islands of Greece. And Cyprus, Crete, and then any of the smaller islands. They're very, very special.
Mm. As a chef then, when you are looking for an authentic place to eat while you're travelling, how do you, that was a great example because the taxi driver told you, but do you have like a special way of sussing out where the decent food's going to be?
Yeah, I mean, chefs have a knack. I mean, I've got to be honest. See, I'm a non-drinker now and I've not drunk for 6 years, but if you're in a town or a city or anywhere and you want someone to find that bar, the place that is open late, the one that's full of diverse mix of characters, the one that you can get anything that you want and the one that also knows where you need to be, that chefs can find that, and we can find that. We have a sixth sense for being able to find that place.
Yeah.
within 2 hours of being in a city, we know, we have found where to go because there's other chefs there. Chefs like that kind of left field way of culture, that's slightly dangerous, on the edge, things that just are not the norm. And then when you are in those bars and there's other chefs and they also know where to eat, where the great food is, whether you're in New York and the best pizzas, or whether you're in Singapore and the best street food, or whether you're in, I mean, it could be anywhere, San Francisco, whether you're in like Italy, it really doesn't matter. Anywhere where we've cooked as chefs, you meet other chefs, you always find the bar where it's a bit questionable, but in that other characters where you're really under the skin of the city, and you know, great places to get late night kebabs or the best coffee or the best, you know, just anything like that. Though chefs will find you that space, and it's a sixth sense, and I can't tell you how we know it. We just know. You know,
wow,
like homing pigeons can just get home from being dry. Chefs can find that bar.
Okay, so when I'm traveling, I need to find a chef.
You need to find yourself a chef. Yeah, you need to find yourself a chef as a travel guru.
Yeah. So speaking of falling in love, at what point did you fall in love with food, would you say?
It's weird because, I mean, I've always loved food. I mean, but it was the industry that I fell in love with first. It was, you know, I walked into a kitchen as an 18-year-old needing a job and money and washing up. And I fell in love with the excitement, the energy, the space, the late nights, the people that work in it, the knives, the fire, the swearing, the jokes, the banter, the pretty waitresses, the just everything about it was just like,
it sounds kind of intoxicating,
yeah,
the way that you're painting.
It's huge, it's amazing. And where everyone else has got a normal life, at 5:30 they leave their office and go and do something else. They go to work. Being a chef, being in the hospitality industry, is a way of life. It isn't just a job. It becomes, it overtakes you. It completes you. It's what it is. It becomes an amazing, immersive experience that, you know, the moment I walked into it as an 18-year-old, it was just like, this is where I want to be. I want this life. This is what I want. This is exciting. It's brilliant. It's great. And so many people will tell you that, I mean, you hear, go, oh, you don't want to get in hospitality. It's not, you know, where's your social life gone? Well, your social life is the best social life. It's brilliant. It's amazing. You know those places. You know the other people that work in them. You go, you can get into the best nightclubs and the best restaurants and you get treated like gods because the people that are there are also the same. You know, you could be a 20-year-old chef with very little money in your back pocket, but you go and eat in a 2-Michelin-star restaurant with other chefs that you know that work there. You know, you'll get a glass of champagne on arrival. You'll get sent out a little course. You get to speak to the chef in the kitchen. And there's all those little perks of the job. Yes, you save that money, but you're in those places. You're part of that life. And it's so exciting. It's just a different type of life, a different type of social mix. You know, you're not just going out on a Friday and Saturday night. You're working, but you may well still go on a Friday and Saturday night, but your evening doesn't start until midnight, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've still got to be back in at work the next day. But they're great. You just have to embrace the excitement of it all, and it is fantastic. And then from that, a love of food grows because you're in that area, you're in that environment, and you start falling in love with the produce and the people. So much of it is about people. It's such an immersive industry to be in that when you're passionate about stuff, you find people that are passionate about the cheese that they make, or the baker that loves his bread, or the farmer that brings in this incredible beef, or the brewer that makes great beer, or the winemaker. And you start meeting people who have food and drink is surrounded by passionate people that do it because they love doing it, not because it's a business that makes money. They do it because this is what they want to do. Mm-hmm. And you cannot help but be inspired and that enthusiasm for product craftsmanship rub off on you. You just get it suddenly becomes this great thing. There's craft and there's culture that goes into it all, and it sums up people in the areas of where they're from. So many different foods can represent terroir, you know, where people are, what that area where it represents and how it's grown and the difference it can make in soil and land, and it's very special to be a part of. To be a part of that is amazing.
It sounds infectious.
It really is. It really is. And, you know, I was very lucky as an 18-year-old for it to find me. I didn't find it. I stumbled across it, and I'm the luckiest guy ever.
So you were 18, you started off washing dishes, and then you fell in love with food, as you say. And how many Michelin stars have you got now?
So the Hand of Flowers, we are a 2-star pub. So I cook, you know, the Hand of Flowers is a 2-star pub. And then we opened the Coach 5 years ago, and that's 1 Michelin star. So we've got a 2-star and a 1-star pub. There's 200 metres from each other on the same road.
Unbelievable. I mean, talk about phenomenal. When you were first getting going, were you viewing that as the pinnacle, you know? Was that what you were striving towards?
No, never. I mean, it wasn't. It was about... when I first entered the kitchen, it was about enjoying cooking and being a chef. And kitchens are very easy to understand and work out. You know, it's a hierarchy system. You start as a pot wash, then you move to a commis chef, and then as a commis chef you move to a chef de partie, which means you run a section, then you're a sous chef that helps oversee the kitchen and understand what the head chef wants and implements that, and then you become a head chef that you're all empowering, and it's your vision and your drive. You know, that's it simplified. However, it is quite easy to work out. So you get on this journey and you move with it and you grow with it and you try and work out how you have to, you base it on knowledge. So you need to pick up as much knowledge as you can. But being a chef isn't always just about the food. It's kitchen craft. Understanding how to run a kitchen is equally important, if not more important, than the understanding of food. Food for me is about the produce. If your kitchen craft is good, you're good at finding the produce. The produce sings for itself and speaks for itself, which allows you to keep your food strong, simple, mm-hmm. and understand technique. And it's a case of those building blocks of getting it together. So being a chef is something that I've just grown with, and I never have or have had an end game or an end plan. We just keep growing. And when I say we, I mean the people that come with us on this journey. I mean, I opened the Hand of Flowers. It was myself and my wife and my best mate behind the bar and a couple of other guys in the kitchen, and that was it. And we just keep growing. And there's people that have been with us for 15, 17 years, people that have been with us for 10, 12 years, people that, like, and this team of people that have kept growing and growing and growing. And now across the board, within the hospitality sector of the business that we run, there's around about 270 staff. So it's a big, but a lot of those people, that management, have been with us for years and years and years. So there's this wonderful backbone of staff that have an understanding of the DNA of what runs through that business. And it is about craft and allowing people to be themselves and allowing them to grow, personal development, professional development, allowing people to expand their own experiences within the group has been so important. That's been key to keeping people on that journey with us. And it's wonderful to see.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
We were just speaking a little earlier about how I visited the Hand and Flowers for a birthday lunch once, and an unforgettable lunch. It's a 2 Michelin star spot, but in the best way, the food is accessible, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%.
It's not scary having to be silent or anything like that.
No, that's the worst thing.
It's the most friendly.
I mean, the Hand of Flowers is a 2 Michelin star space and it's amazing. It's got 15 tables, but on the menu is a chicken dish that is inspired by Bernie Inns when I was a kid. There's steak and chips. Yeah. There's, we have fish and chips on at lunchtime. There's always a game dish, whether it's pheasant or partridge or venison. There is, we always have a soup on, a terrine on. There will always be a souffle. There's creme brulee that's on all the time. There's a smoked haddock omelette. It's food that people, you understand it. When you read the menu, you'll understand it. However, we do drive and push the technique to get the best out of the ingredient to create they're building blocks. A lot of people will talk about food as being artistic. Now, I'm not an artistic chef in that form of creativity. I'm a builder. I understand how to build a plate of food that has to cover taste with texture, that is about salt and sour, acidity, where it comes from, sweetness, where is a layer of richness, and they're all building blocks of building a plate together that has to be about what people want to eat. I'm not up for being groundbreaking in terms of flavors and profiles and trying to drive the boundaries of technique. What I want to do is just make the best steak and chips, or I want to do a really good chicken dish or a really good game dish that people understand. Nothing that pushes people to question, my God, I don't really know what to eat here. Yeah. You know, that fear of going, which knife and fork do I use? All of that stuff. I don't, you know. So 3-course meal, start a main dessert. You can have a bowl of soup and a steak and chips and a creme brulee. That's it. I mean, that's it. You should feel comfortable doing that. That's no problem. And if you want to drink Diet Coke or a pint of local beer, that's great. You know, there's no issue.
Love that. So chapter 3 then is the place where you learnt the most about yourself.
Yeah. I mean, there's a couple of places, and I mean, I'll broadly use Asia, and I've only been to Asia twice and to 2 different places, Singapore a couple of times and Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And both times it was to showcase British produce, to go out there cooking. And I've been blown away by Singapore. Some people, Singaporeans have told me, when I was out there, I hung out with quite a few Singaporeans, journalists and chefs. And Singapore is Asia for beginners. It's a good place to start, you know, to get under the skin of different cultures and life. But the food there is absolutely phenomenal. It's incredible, from posh end, top end restaurants, which is great. But actually, then you go out with chefs and we find those bars and places and the late night places where you can go and eat. You know, the street food there is just fantastic. It's absolutely stunning. And the same as in Hong Kong as well, there are some incredible, beautiful, brilliant restaurants, late night noodle places, and food that is so removed from what I do. And it is inspiring in so many ways because there is an energy and a passion for it. But it's the place where I've learned that I'm not a chef like this. I don't live in this environment. The thing about Singapore and Hong Kong, it's not seasonal. You know, the weather is very similar. The produce is very similar. Like Hong Kong, like it's, a lot of it is then imported, you know. And there's these great flavors and it's absolutely stunning. But it is relentlessly, to the point of possibly monotony if you live there, the same sort of thing all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've learned very much to be incredibly proud of being British, understanding what we do, and we have 4 defined seasons, you know, and we can change our food. It can move. Summertime, we've got wonderful peas, and it moves through to, you know, broad beans and runner beans and asparagus in the spring, and then the end of summer, you've got wonderful red fruits that are so sweet, and then you move on to apples and pears, and you know, we have this great produce that comes through Britain that is hugely different. And so I learned so much more about actually being super proud of what we do by traveling and going somewhere else.
And embracing seasonality as a result.
Hugely, yeah. Hugely. But also wishing that we had more in the way, it is growing and it is getting better, but the quality of cheaper-y, street foodie eats, the fact that people, you know, the best thing about street food and that street food market that's moved over the last 10 years that has influenced what happens here, we're taking away food snobbery, because I hate food snobbery. I hate it. Listen, there's brilliant special places to go and eat, and I love all of that. But people who just think eating in a 3-Michelin-star restaurant is the only good food out there, that's not true.
Yeah.
There's brilliant fish and chip places you can just get and go and sit on a beach in Brighton and eat fish and chips and enjoy the seagulls trying to pinch it. Like that sort of stuff is amazing.
Can create as special a food memory as well.
Absolutely, if not better. I mean, we've all eaten in Michelin-star restaurants where you sit there and you go, yes, everything about this is exact and perfect, but where's the heart, where's the soul? And that's the beautiful thing about street food that's come through from places like Singapore and Hong Kong, where it is driven by an energy and a vibrancy and an excitement, and great food is the norm. You know, tasty, super great food is the norm. So being there and being able to represent Great Britain, because when I've been out there, we've exported British produce to showcase to the marketplace that's there. The point of going wasn't holiday, it was for business, or representing the Great Campaign for Great Britain,
that's
or showcasing Britain. So it's been a wonderful thing to do, but it also embraces, it helps you learn, and it's helped me learn to be a lot prouder of the food that we do in Great Britain.
And what foods did they then particularly embrace that you were taking over there. Were there any particular products or ingredients that they got most excited about?
Yeah, strange, potatoes are a big thing because it's quite difficult as a growing point of view, and the soils and the time that it takes, and then the storage. So things like doing chips properly, or roast potatoes, or just baking, or just the flavours, the profile that you can get from different potatoes has been because it's not the norm out there. You know, it's not, but they're a flavour that isn't too. And the other one that always spins is cheese. So cheese to an Asian market is quite a strange.
Yeah, it's not widely consumed in Asia at all, is it?
Not at all. No. I mean, they view cattle as it's a different way. You know, if you explain cheese to someone who doesn't eat it, I mean, it's pretty. I mean, if you explain blue cheese to someone, we take the milk from the cow, then we stir it until it separates. Then all the stuff that's separated from the top, we pack into like a box and then stick it in a cave. Then we inject it with something mold to make it go like blue. I mean, it's a pretty alien concept to somebody who's just, you know, poaching a little bit of Wagyu beef and a really lovely miso broth. It's something you do what with the milk?
It's kind of
like, you know, it is really removed from the concept. So that's quite an interesting cheese and potatoes. Yeah. They've been really good to showcase out there. They've been really good.
That's really interesting. So speaking of learning about ourselves, I'm sure many of us, it being January, are trying to stick to some New Year's resolutions, maybe to lose weight or get fit. So it's rather handy that you've got a new book and TV series about both of these things.
Yeah. So, I mean, I find myself as a 46-year-old who's been on a massive weight loss journey and then is trying on that balance to maintain it for the last 5 or 6 years. And I'm going through different processes of understanding my body, what I want, where I want to be in life, and how it, how food and fitness affects our everyday lives, and then also trying to get control of it. You know, trying to understand eating food is massive. We all do it. We all do it all the time. And the idea of being on a diet for some people is just the worst thing, because you worry about what you're going to miss. Now, the biggest thing for me is that I come from the diet viewpoint of, I'm not a dietitian, I'm not a nutritionist, I'm not a personal trainer, I'm not a, you go, okay, so how do I look at it? Well, I'm looking at it like a chef, and it's focusing on how food tastes. What, focus on the food that you can eat rather than worry about the food that you're going to miss and the food that you can't eat. And then at the same point, the way that you go through the fitness process is also another an extra thing, because, you know, you want to move more and you want to do stuff. I went through a process, I lost a load of weight, I did swimming every day and I'd swim a big distance and I'd love it, and then I changed it up a little bit through travel, and I was always worried that there was never going to be swimming pools in hotels that I was staying in, but there's quite often a gym. So I changed what I did, my gym work, and I went from being swimming to weightlifting, and I tried to get to the point where I could lift as much as possible. But the problem with lifting, I was bulking, I was getting much bigger, so I was putting weight on, although it was different. And there was a big difference between being strong and fit. Like, it's a different, like, however, you don't see, I didn't see that until, actually, I need to do something here. I need to get back in control of it. So this is the process. I mean, the book and the TV series are, there's 12 volunteers who are going on a weight loss program to lose weight and get fit. I write the recipes. My best friend Adam is a personal trainer, and he's doing the training tips of how to get fit. But it's not about joining a gym. It's about, you know, things that you can do at home and movement. But this time I am actually one of the guinea pigs. I'm taking part in it. So in that whole process, we film it over an 8-week period and see where we are from week 1 to week 8. So we see where we get to.
Oh, that's so exciting. And how did it? Well, you can't give us the kind of big reveal at the end.
No, I can't.
Like, how was the
I mean,
journey?
I can't reveal. However, you know, like, it's the TV show's good. There's some life-changing moments for people. We do some really great stuff, and, you know, the recipes work.
Very cool. When you travel, then, do you try and stick to this regime, or do you just kind of give yourself a break?
Well, it's very difficult. My life works. It's gone from being in a kitchen every day, from where I had routine of what I'm doing, to there is absolutely no routine in my working life right now. We have, you know, we have a butcher's and two pubs in Marlow. We have a restaurant in Manchester, one in London, and then everything else that we do on top of that. And so there really is no structure. And that's very difficult to stay on a form of regime or just eating habit. I mean, regime makes it sound horrible. Regime makes it sound, but diet makes it sound bad. Diet is
a routine.
A routine. Diet is just the way we eat, things that we eat. So I find being on a lower calorie diet is easier than being a low carb. Now, low carb is the way that I lost a load of weight because I alienated a food group. I can concentrate on it. I was working in the kitchen and this is where I'm driving. 6 years on, my life is slightly different. There's much more variant to it. So lower calorie means that if you do travel and you are somewhere else, you can enjoy having wonderful sourdough in San Francisco. You can enjoy having brilliant noodles and ramen somewhere in Hong Kong. You can enjoy having, you know, brilliant bowl of pasta somewhere in Italy whilst your wife is carving stone. You know, you can make the most of it, but you just have to bring everything into balance over a week kind of structure and go, right, okay, well, that was a bad day. The next day I can do, well, I'll just counterbalance it by being much better this day, you know. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lower carbohydrate diet is there's very little in the way of wavering. You just have to kind of stay on that point. So, it is hard, but it's only this, you know, it's the same as anything. If you want something and you want it enough, you have to concentrate and focus on it.
Mm-hmm. So chapter four is your all-time favorite destination.
Now, I'm not really... Hong Kong, I absolutely loved. Now, I loved it as an amazing, sprawling metropolis where there's no parks. There's not much in the way of outdoor space. There's nothing. It's just this great lot. It's almost like somewhere from a sci-fi movie where it just keeps going up and up and up and up and up. And there's an energy and a spark and it's brilliant. And it is amazing for 3 or 4 days. However, I think being there much longer, it's like it's quite full on,
quite intense.
It's quite intense, but I loved it. I loved the intensity of it. I loved the vibrancy of it. It was fantastic. But I got to be honest, a place that I truly love visiting, and where I think the food scene is great, and I think there's so much to go and see and do. And again, it's quite seasonal. Is New York? I'm a big fan of New York. Last year, I did about 5 weeks out in the States, traveling all over doing something for a food network and visiting lots of different parts of America, which was a true privilege and amazing. And, you know, the diversity of being down in Tucson in Arizona, going all the way up to Vermont and, you know, over to, the, you know, to Miami or Florida Keys. And then, you know, it was just all over the place. It was great.
Yeah.
But New York, you can get much, it's like a massive, vibrant London, and there's park spaces there. There's a brilliant food scene there. There's fantastic coffee culture. There's art scene there. There's so much, and you can do a great weekend there. But you could also be there for a week and go and, you know, really enjoy it. You would spend a week in the summer there. You know, it's just a New York for me is a brilliant, brilliant, brilliant place to spend, and it's not like being in America, if that makes sense. Like, having done the rest of America, everyone thinks New York is America. New York is in America.
Yeah.
New York is an incredible, busy, brilliant, vibrant city that is almost a country to itself. It's a bit like Singapore. Singapore is very similar, like this great, big, vibrant city and country that is, you know, they're very similar. And I love those kind of places. I love a place that has an energy and an excitement about it. As much as I love holidays where you go and read a book, have gone for me because I've got a 4-year-old son. So the moment you have a child, a holiday where you sit down and you read a book, that's gone. That doesn't exist anymore. Babysitting in a hot country. That's it. You know. So those moments have disappeared. I'm looking forward to him going off to wherever he's going to be as an 18-year-old. Hopefully, I don't know, signed by a Premier League football team or driving Formula One. Either one is fine. But, you know, and then I can get those holidays back. But that's fine by me. I'm happy with those. That's really, really cool. But otherwise, New York is a brilliant space for me to be.
Mm. And how about chapter five, which is your hidden gem, perhaps a spot that we might not know that much about that you've fallen in love with?
So to be honest, I'm going to stay in this country for that one. I'm going to stick with the UK and I'm going to go for the North Kent coast.
Oh, great.
And I absolutely love it. I love Whitstable. I love Sea Salter. I love the view from the beach. It's a pebble beach and you look out and there's amazing wind turbines and there's fantastic old forts from the war that you can see. It's a great view and also great big ocean going liners that go across the back or that have the big tankers. There's something quite industrial about it, but also it's a seaside resort. And the Whitstable, again, it's a foodie area. The North Kent coast is foodie. Canterbury is fantastic. You know, there's the Good Shed there, which is a brilliant kind of a produce led shed next to the old disused railway line but there's different producers and suppliers in there and a little restaurant in there, and it's a great place. You've got the Fordwich Arms, which has just won a Michelin star. You've got the Compasses Inn in Crundale, which isn't too far as well, which is a beautiful rural pub, which is absolutely brilliant. And then you've also got, of course, the Sportsman in Sea Salter, which is, you know, arguably Britain's best loved and most amazing pub that's right on the coast. It uses food from around the area, that uses, you know, salt marsh lamb that's beautiful, that uses sea herbs and vegetables from the shoreline, makes their own butter, makes their own seaweed butter, cooks beautiful fish. Like, it's very, very simple, but it's amazing. So the North Kent coast for me is somewhere really special, really chilled. You haven't got to get on a plane. You haven't got to get any of the stresses of travelling. You could just get to the North Kent coast, enjoy it in the sunshine. But also, there's something really magical about British seaside towns in the winter.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I love them. I absolutely
love
them.
In the winter.
In the when it's raining and it's snowing or and you go for a really blustery walk on the beach with the dogs and then you find somewhere and have a hot chocolate and just, you know, just those sorts of things. You blow the cobwebs away and you
totally,
really do.
Yeah.
I love English seaside towns in the wintertime.
In contrast then, chapter 6 is a place that you'd never go back to.
I wouldn't go back to. I was very lucky that this Christmas I went to Lapland.
I
took our little man who's 4 to go and see, and we went with friends and their daughter who's the same age, and we went to go and see Santa. And it was amazing. The elves came and picked us up from the hotel and we went out into the woods and we went to go see Santa in his workshop and everything was just magical. And you can't repeat that. You just can't recreate that magic to see kids' faces having had that amazing, wonderful time and go out went on a husky sled run. And, you know, the hotel has got its own little toboggan space next to it so the kids could jump on the sledges and, you know, go. Like, it was just everything about it was a magical 3 or 4 days. And it was very special. You know, you manage to eat local foods, hang out in, you know, it was lovely. So, but we can't go back. You know,
recreate that magic.
Exactly.
Yeah,
he's met Santa once. Yeah. That'll do. We'll just have to remind him every year and tell him, you know, you've got to continue being good. Otherwise, Santa's not going to visit.
Yeah, because now he's a personal friend.
That's exactly it. Yeah, exactly.
So chapter 7 is your next big adventure.
I'd like to do a lot more Scandinavia. I love the idea of Eastern Europe as well. I love the idea of Germany and Poland and Austria, those kind of foods. Again, my travel is all about, you know, food and art, you know, because of Beth and, you know, going to see an art scene and a vibrancy. We love not urban living, but left field, people that make statements, people that are living a life rather than just letting life happen around them. So places where that is happening. But also, we both talk about, I'd like to, never been, and we'd love to do India, and Beth would love to do India, and I'd be a big fan of going to see India, the vibrancy, the culture, the noise, the smells, the sounds, the food, the everything. So India would be that's very high up on our list. And Japan, I really would love to go to Japan. Now, I've got lots of chef friends that have been, and just the way the respect that is paid to a food culture in Japan is absolutely, you know, second to none. The way that, you know, the ingredients are loved and cared for, and, you know, from start to finish, something like that. That I would love to do Japan. I've done neither of them, and I would love to do them both, India and Japan.
So some of those are perhaps perhaps on Chapter 8 as well, which is what's at the top of your bucket list? Are they your bucket list destinations?
Japan is a bucket list. Japan is getting out there. But I don't... The problem I've got... See, there is a big issue, is that I have a shellfish allergy.
Ah.
Going there, not speaking Japanese, not really understanding... Like, I would need to go with someone with a guiding hand. And and that's the way to do it as well. It would probably have to be a chef-led food trip, mm-hmm, with people who know things. We'd find those places. And when I find them, I'll come back and tell you which ones to go to.
Oh, amazing. Thank you so much, Tom Kerridge. Those were your travel diaries. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Pleasure's all mine. Thank you.
That was the utterly delightful Tom Kerridge. I think a foodie weekend break to the North Kent coast is now on my 2020 to-do list. And the Greek island of Agistri. I'd never heard of it. Had a Google and it looks like absolute paradise. So that's a great one to know about. If you've enjoyed this episode, scrolling down to leave a 5-star review or a rating really helps other people to discover the podcast. And to find out who's on next week's show, come and find me on Instagram. I'm at Holly Rubenstein. I'd love to hear from you. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next week. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb. And what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden, and my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom, and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.